Welcome to FinSight, the global financial institutions sector podcast. My name is Luke Lightford. I'm a partner at Baker McKenzie's finance group based in London. I advise on a wide variety of international emerging markets financing transactions. I'm primarily involved in cross-border trade, export, and project finance. In this episode of FinSight, we will be discussing adaptation finance and one of the most promising funding methods, debt for impact swaps. My colleagues joining me today are also from our London office, Matt Cox and James Tanner. Matt, James, would you introduce yourselves, please?
Thank you, Luca. It is a pleasure to join you on this podcast. I am a partner in the Baker McKenzie Banking Group. I'm based in London. My practice, and sort of I specialize in leverage and acquisition finance and restructurings and cross-border sort of international financing. And particularly, well, specifically in this respect, sustainable finance is, you know, something that's really growing in importance in the market and in my practice.
Thanks so much, Luca. It's great to be here. I'm also a partner in our London office where I advise on debt capital markets transactions, securitizations, and portfolio sales and acquisitions. As Matt said, sustainable finance is rapidly expanding to occupy a lot of our time, and green bond markets in particular have been an area of focus for me for the last few years.
Thank you, James and Matt. Thanks for joining today. Today we will be talking about climate change adaptation finance, which is a critical but underfunded element of the goals in the Paris Agreement. Currently, most adaptation finance comes from the public sector, a stark contrast to the sums provided by institutional investors and commercial banks for adaptation finance, which make up reportedly less than 3%. But the amount of finance needed is significant and substantial. And the gap between what is available and what is required presents a huge opportunity for both institutional investors and commercial banks. According to the Global Center on Adaptation, despite the growth in adaptation finance, it has fallen as a percentage of overall climate finance. It also reports that developing countries need adaptation finance flows to increase at least fourfold. Similarly, the UN Environment Programme estimates a gap for developing countries of about $200 to $350 billion per year this decade. These are significant sums. Matt, we are all aware of sustainable finance, but for those who don't follow this space closely, could you explain to our listeners what this subset of sustainable finance consists of?
Sure. Thanks, Luca. There is a lot of press and growing awareness of sustainable finance, but you're right, adaptation finance is something that is not as well known. So when we talk about adaptation finance, what we're referring to is finance and structures and deals that help communities, help businesses, and you know, at a greater scale, countries adapt or reduce vulnerability to the impact of climate change. That's what you're really getting at, adapting to the impact of the vulnerability in respect of climate change. Building in climate change resilience is closely related to adaptation. Adaptation aims to reduce vulnerability to risks posed by climate change. It can also be used to take advantage of beneficial opportunities which climate change offers and presents. Examples of adaptation projects include relocating infrastructure from areas likely to be flooded, in agriculture, providing drought-resistant seeds, and even, you know, on a larger scale, improving water management in areas prone to drought. In the EU, its taxonomy regulation, six environmental objects, includes climate change adaptation. Under its technical screening criteria, and that's I think of that as performance criteria, under its technical screening criteria, certain economic activities may qualify as contributing substantially to climate change adaptation. An example of that would be the installation of renewable energy technologies. So hopefully that's helpful to set out, you know, what we talk about when we mean, when we say adaptation finance.
Thanks, Matt. That was really clear and helpful. And just to give this some further context, as we recently had COP29 late last year, one of the priorities in Baku was a new collective quantified goal on climate finance to replace $100 billion per year goal. This funding, paid by developed countries, is a key part of the Paris Agreement to support developing countries in their climate response. In the event, after much negotiation, developed countries agreed to increase this sum to $300 billion a year by the end of 2025. All parties, in addition to this, will work together to scale up finance to developing countries from both public and private sources to the tune of $1.3 trillion by 2035. So this really does put our discussion in context. This agreement at COP29 offers a great opportunity to expand the private sector's role and bridge the finance gap. And here, institutional investors and commercial banks are crucial. That said, in bridging the finance gap and getting private finance more involved, there are also non-financial barriers to negotiate. James, may I come to you now? Would you speak to some of these non-financial barriers?
Thanks, Luca. Sure, I'd be happy to. So I think what I'd say first is there is at the moment a lack of a common market language. And by this, I mean a standard set of definitions and a sort of classification framework that can speak to adaptation finance. So by making a comparison to, say, transition finance has structures in place that help us identify activities, helps us inform decision-making, it helps make the market participants able to speak to each other more easily. The world of adaptation finance, by contrast, is a bit more nascent, and there's no equivalent of anything like the transition principles or the green loan or green bond principles. But that said, some of these can be applied towards adaptation finance, but it's not an exact fit. Now, in this area, it's worth mentioning briefly the impact of the EU taxonomy regulation, as this does provide a sort of classification framework, which can be applied in some respects to adaptation finance. So, to the extent that conditions are met under the EU taxonomy regulation, we can use these sometimes to talk about adaptation finance and make adaptation finance be deemed green, for example, in the context of an EU green bond. Additionally, there's also a lack of detailed information on climate risk relevant to specific projects, which can obscure their actual quantifiable environmental benefits. And related to this are challenges around disclosure and sharing of information on those projects. These issues are understandable. They derive from client confidentiality, the commercial sensitivities, data protection, all things that market participants should be well aware of. And this is all important to the market, as whether you're a borrower, a lender, or an advisor, you need to be comfortable both around financing risk and due diligence, but also in ensuring that your confidentiality concerns are met. Maybe one more issue I'd raise would come from a sort of timeline mismatch. Institutional investors and banks and other financing parties need to see a return on their investment within reasonable timescales. Some of the projects that are required for adaptation finance, however, have much longer timescales before any real results are actually seen. So we need to find ways in which the commercial concerns of the financing entities are balanced with the reasonable requirements for adaptation finance taking some time to see fruit. So all of that said, it can be a little bit difficult to properly price and calculate the risk and returns that are inherent in adaptation finance. Sometimes the actual money generated can be pretty modest in the short term, but the value would be derived in a much longer terms. And it's just a little bit difficult, and we're all working as market participants to find ways that we can adequately describe this on balance sheets.
Many thanks, James. That was really helpful. Matt, do you want to add to the barriers to closing the finance gap?
Yeah, thanks, Luca. Look, James has covered it, and I agree with him, of course. If you think about the barriers that James mentioned, common language, information, disclosure requirements, timelines, price, just think about those barriers. And in my mind, I mean, some of those are, you know, perceived more than real, perceived more than actual. The way that the market addresses those and how we're going to, you know, overcome those barriers is going to require a range of measures. It's going to require a number of stakeholders, to take steps. It's going to need greater support from governments. It's going to need the market and all participants in the market to agree standardized approaches. And of course, things like, you know, increased disclosure and reporting of information is something that, you know, all participants are going to need to sort of get on board with. The other issue, I think, around pricing is interesting, but my hope, or at least my sense, is that a better understanding of the opportunities and, you know, the potential outcomes for these deals and the ability to achieve a commercial return, it's fundamental. But as the market develops and more information is available, more deals are done, then I'm hopeful this will drive more consistent and better pricing for these super important transactions.
Thank you, Matt. Now, to move us along, coming to the promising funding methods, there are, of course, a variety. There's the usual choice between the use of equity, where risk and reward are shared with investors, or debt, which must be serviced with interest. Today, blended finance is one that we have seen most commonly used in the market, which combines concessional public finance with non-concessional private finance and expertise from both the public and private sector. But today, and the focus of this FinSide podcast, I wanted to talk to you both about debt for impact swaps, a market which I know that you've both been very active in. So Matt, I mean, perhaps you can kick us off by explaining what these swaps are.
Thanks, Luca. Yeah, I mean, happy to do so. A lot has been written about debt for nature swaps and debt for impact swaps, as they're also known. And I think it's important sometimes just to make sure you sort of step back and look at the basics of the transaction, as that allows you to really understand and identify, you know, the opportunities and the challenges to them. So under a debt for impact swap, a sovereign debtor, a sovereign borrower whose debt is trading at a discount, ultimately repays existing debt or swaps existing debt via the issuance of a new set of debt at or near par. And it's at a lower face amount that's issued because the existing debt's trading at a discount. So they swap a higher amount for a lower amount. And the sovereign debtor, through the benefit of reducing the amount of its debt service, the amount of its debt and the amount of its debt service, can direct a percentage of the savings to finance local, in this case, climate adaptation projects. So a good example of that, so that's the theory. A good example in practice is the debt for nature finance swap by Ecuador in 2023. And, you know, as participants will have seen in the market, they've done another one in 2024. The 2023 swap was the largest in value ever done. Ecuador's existing sovereign bonds with a face value of over $1.6 billion were exchanged for a US dollar 650-odd million loan, which was funded from the proceeds of a marine-linked bond. But the question is how you can go from a position of $1.6 billion to $650 million. And the answer is, crucially, that the new bonds benefit from political risk insurance and from development bank guarantees. And that means that they're issued on more favorable terms. They're issued at a higher rating and a more favorable price than the existing bonds, which don't benefit from the insurance and guarantees. And it's that which unlocks the financial difference, and it's that that allows Ecuador, and they'll be generating more than $300 million US dollars in savings over the life of the project, allows them to direct those savings towards these projects. I mean, James, I don't know if you've got anything to add on that.
Yep. Thanks, Matt. I think, well, I would just note that this is a product that just a couple of years ago had only been done at a very small scale and only bilaterally amongst one or two creditor-debtor relationships. But just within the last year or two, it's become a tried and tested model. It, however, does suffer from a bit of capacity constraint in that the credit support, which Matt, you were talking about, is only currently provided by a couple of large multilateral banks and development finance institutions. So these have big budgets and big capacity, but it's not unlimited. Whereas the private sector has effectively unlimited capacity to write this sort of credit protection. So as the market develops and more sovereigns and similar entities are clamoring for these sorts of swaps, we expect and we hope that private finance will step into the gap and provide the sort of insurance and guarantee credit supports that will enable a vastly larger number of these potential transactions. And maybe just to pick up on one other point on just a bit of nomenclature, as you said, Matt, these a year or two ago would have only been called debt for nature swaps, but the terminology seems to be shifting much more to debt for impact swaps. And this reflects the fact that these swaps can ultimately utilize the savings for anything that the new creditors and the credit support providers agree will be used. So as the private sector moves into this role of providing the credit support, private sector creditors and credit support providers will be able to help choose how these savings are allocated towards the sorts of projects that they and their own investors would like to see done. So this private sector involvement can allow private sector creditors not only to achieve a good return, but also choose how these sort of savings are allocated.
Yeah, I agree, James. I agree with all of that. I mean, I think from what we've spoken about and obviously what we're seeing in the market, the demand is there for these transactions. And I think, you know, one of the other opportunities or challenges is to find the political will to allocate resources. And you need that at both the sponsor level and at a sovereign debtor level. And those resources, of course, are both financial and non-financial. And there's lots of priorities, you know, which are competing and clamoring for attention and for resources. But you know, as we're witnessing again and again from global events, you know, climate change and adaptation is important. I've fully acknowledge resources are scarce. Fully, you know, understand the geopolitical landscape is uncertain. But while we see these events happening, it's just, you know, critical. It's important that together, you know, participants in the market look to make progress on closing this finance gap.
So there, and plenty of opportunities in finance to make a difference. Thank you both so much, Matt and James, for talking to us today. If you would like to know more about this topic, you can read our article published by the World Economic Forum entitled Climate Adaptation Finance and the Challenge for Institutional Investors and Commercial Banks. We hope that you have found this podcast useful. As always, please do reach out to your usual Baker McKenzie contact or any of today's speakers, Matt, James, if there are any specific areas or projects you would like us to talk through. We're always more than happy to help where we can. Thanks again to everyone for listening, and we hope you can join Baker McKenzie for the next episode of FinSight. Goodbye.